But I think we have on the line Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
Pardon me for making you listen to History of War of 1812. We're glad to have you. You have written a piece, which is maybe we might call The Lessons of Wars, that focuses on whether or not the U.S. intends to engage in what would be hostile or aggressive activity towards Syria, although nowhere in the Western media do I get see any discussion of the sovereignty of the country of Syria. And it all has to do with this phenomenon called this thing called the caliphate or the ISIS. And your thesis is that ISIS/caliphate is a pretext. Is that right?
Is a pretext?
Pretext once again return troops to Iraq and Syria. But particularly, I think you're focusing on what they have in mind for Syria.
Yeah, I mean, ISIS may very well serve as a Trojan horse to escalate the war in the Syrian government. I've been paying close attention to this for a number of months. Occasionally, you'll see rumblings about how the U.S. may have to intervene in Syria or to deal with the threat of ISIS. I mean, this has been going on for months and months, but it really escalated into a fear-mongering program in the last few weeks, in which ISIS has suddenly become a major threat, in the words of U.S. officials.
Yeah, by the way, your article has amazing quotes from these gentlemen about then we're entering a whole new world and we've never seen anything like this.
I mean, the U.S. Defense Secretary, Chuck Hagel, saying that ISIS is an imminent threat to every interest we have. It's beyond anything that we've ever seen. And he doesn't say how ISIS is a threat to even one U.S. interest, let alone all of them. And, you know, this elevation of ISIS to a threat beyond anything that we've seen is just transparent fear-mongering. Mm-hmm. You know, clearly, I mean, ISIS's brutality in Iraq and its beheading of the U.S. journalist Foley and its ability to seize and control territory have been no more shocking than what has transpired in Syria, you know, where ISIS and its fellow Islamists have carried out equally bloody displays of depraved cruelty, have seized and controlled sizable swaths of Syrian territory, and amply assisted, though, by members of the U.S.-led Friends of Syria. So all of this has happened in Syria, so you have to ask, why is it suddenly elevated to such an enormous threat when it happens in Iraq?
Yeah, by the way, I'm curious about this cycle. You know, here we were 1 year ago, I think we were speaking to you, among others, about this matter. The U.S. was beating the drums, and they said, Syria has chemical weapons, and we're going to have to, and the president said that the president of Syria has no right to be the president. He has to step down. That was the president of the United States exercising his authority as the elected president of the American people, telling Assad he had to step down. And we actually came right to the point where it looked like it was a matter of hours that the U.S. was going to strike. But they had a breakdown in that Mr. Putin surprised them with a rather strong statement saying that there's no way they were going to allow the Security Council, the United Nations, to permit that. And then the British Parliament got cold feet. But here we are now, we've gone around on the calendar, and now they say, well, now we have the biggest terror threat anybody ever saw, and we're going to have to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Do these guys have some sort of a, you know, clock they're working on? It's almost like, you know, well, hey, it's September, it's time to bomb Syria, you know.
And the way in which they're trying to elevate this threat and fear-mongering is kind of irritating in a way, because it's so transparent. I mean, we had the France's foreign minister saying, this is just completely unbelievable, saying The attacks in New York on September 11, 2001 cost $1 million, but today the Islamic State has several billions. The obvious conclusion he wants us to draw is that ISIS is going to launch thousands of 9/11s. And Hagel, the U.S. Defense Secretary, is kind of echoing these same sentiments, talking about the danger of ISIS. But interestingly, this is not broadly reported, but interestingly, the FBI and Homeland Security Department say, quote, that there are no specific or credible threats to the U.S. homeland from the Islamic State militant group.
Well, that's a problem.
So we have the U.S. state talking, you know, delivering two stories. One's delivered loudly because it's amplified by the press. The other you really don't hear about.
Yeah. Well, it is quite surprising. Maybe I shouldn't say surprising. You point out, I mean, your opening paragraph discusses the fact that that they have to have a campaign of deception to provide a pretext for military intervention, but which and that that could serve in this case, as you say, as a Trojan horse. But you know, we have the Toronto Star is quite bellicose on the subject. A man named Haroon Siddiqui, who was former national editor of the Toronto Star, he advocated bombing Damascus some time back. You know, when they start off 3 or 4 years ago saying, well, why don't you bomb Damascus in the name of the Free Syrian Army? And then a period of time goes by, and then they, and then this kind of talk about ISIS, it's they've already given themselves away as to what they want.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you should advocate bombing Damascus, and I don't know if he also supported the Libyan air war on, or the air war, the NATO air war on, or on Libya. But I mean, what would be the rationale for bombing Damascus? The same as that was used for Libya, which was to protect people who were being repressed and violently repressed by a government?
That's my understanding.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at the popular uprisings that were part of the Arab Spring, and you say, okay, so there was one in Syria, there was one in Libya, but there was one in Egypt, there was one in Saudi Arabia, there was one in Bahrain, and in all of those cases, these popular uprisings were violently suppressed. And yet, why is it that no one talks about intervening in Saudi Arabia or in Bahrain or in Egypt? Just was it last week, Human Rights Watch said that the current government of Egypt, the current president, should be held responsible for crimes against humanity, for killing thousands of Muslim Brotherhood supporters who are peacefully demonstrating against the ouster of the legitimately elected president. Yet it's strange that we don't hear the Toronto Star or other newspapers talking about bombing Cairo, for example. Yes.
Well, and Ken, I think you're speaking of Kenneth Roth, Human Rights Watch, and he issued a statement, when a tweet, he gives a tweet, and he says that he is for the that President Hollande is right, and the Syrian President Assad isn't an anti-terrorist partner, but effectively an ISIS ally. Now, I mean, which is the dumber of these two? I mean, and by the way, I mean, this is, you know, the where do we reject both of them? I mean, it's that's absurd. The ISIS has been killing Christians and others, Kurds, Shia, and Sunni. And by the way, it's pointed out they kill more Sunni than they do Shia, this particular group. And Assad's government has been fighting them as effectively as possible and indeed had success. One wonders, are they punishing him for success?
Yes. Well, I mean, that's something that's kind of irritating. We had the U.S. intervention or bombing recently in Iraq, presumably to protect the Yazidis from ISIS. Yet no one was doing anything to protect all these minority populations or even Sunnis in Syria who were being slaughtered and murdered by ISIS. And no one cared about them. They still don't care about them.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, I mean, this concern about the minority populations in Iraq is completely insincere.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, and it's gowans.wordpress.com. And the article is the most recent. You can find it at gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, on this matter of who they're up against, it's also this thing called the caliphate. It has an ideology. It can be kind of broken down into its pieces and what it represents. There's only one place or two places where that same ideology is spoken regularly, and that's Qatar and Saudi Arabia. And yet, no one, Washington never mentions this. So you just spoke of it, but I mean, we're talking about brotherly language and ideology.
Yeah, I mean, in particular, it's a Saudi ideology. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, we had Barack Obama, or we had the press reporting that Obama and his top cabinet officials have all denounced the Islamic State as a medieval menace, but they certainly aren't denouncing Saudi Arabia as a medieval menace. And one of the reasons they call ISIS a medieval menace is because it beheads people. And interestingly, the same day that the U.S. state was denouncing ISIS as a medieval menace, it was reported that Saudi Arabia had beheaded at least 19 convicted criminals since August 4th, and nearly half of them for nonviolent offenses, including one for sorcery.
Sorcery. Very serious.
So we hear nothing about from the president and his top cabinet officials about this medieval menace.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly haven't invoked, the beheadings that are done by their Saudi allies as a reason to launch airstrikes on mm-hmm. the Saudi tyranny.
Well, now, and when you think about the consequences, where, and it seems to me this is where the most dangerous aspect, particularly for us living in Canada, anybody in North America, that we have these Congress and Parliament, we're not hearing any discussion. Nobody talks about the modalities. If you say, as Mr. Roth and Hollande, you can't deal with Assad, but we've got to go after ISIS. So the question would be, the Syrian government has said, well, if you want to fight terrorism, we're here. We're all for it. But you obviously have to respect the existence of our government and the sovereignty of our airspace. If you want to come and bomb, that would have to be coordinated with ourselves. Now, that is patent. That would any Canadian would understand if there was a little problem somewhere here and someone said, well, we're going to come and fix that. You'd say, well, no, you're not going to come and fix it. We have a border. We have an Air Force. We have a government. But here, this is all just brushed aside. We wouldn't stop to talk about that. And so the answer, like to the question that you ended the article about, would this lead to a war with Syria? How could it not? I mean, Syria is not going to surrender its sovereignty. And so if it doesn't surrender its sovereignty, you're going to have a war, right?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I wasn't thinking about it in particularly that way, but I mean, that's certainly a good point. The way I was thinking about it was that this might be used as a pretext to, well, I suspect that the U.S. would in bomb ISIS targets, but would soon expand their bombing list to include Syrian forces as well.
Yeah, by the way, I was going to ask you that too, because Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State under Obama, she was very big on, her favorite phrase was no-fly zone, and which meant an American fly zone.
Mm-hmm.
And now they did that to Libya with horrible consequences. They lied to the world. And if they say, well, okay, we found some bad guys in Syria, it'll become, they won't use the phrase, but the logic is rather the same, isn't it? That because once a U.S. establishes its control of airspace, that's their airspace.
Yeah.
I would assume forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the idea of, you know, sovereignty of borders, I mean, doesn't really apply to those countries that are designated by the United States as its enemies. I think it only applies to those that it designates as its allies, like Ukraine, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Sovereignty of borders seem to be important there.
Oh, absolutely. And if truckloads of food and medicine, that's an act of war.
And that's another thing, that there was a big hue and cry about the Syrian government refusing to allow humanitarian assistance to be delivered in Syria without their concurrence.
Mm-hmm.
And the Security Council decided that the sovereignty of Syria was irrelevant, and that they would go ahead and deliver this humanitarian aid,
mm-hmm.
Regardless of what the Syrian government thought. And yet it's curious that when the Russian government uses the same argument to deliver humanitarian aid in Ukraine.
Yeah. The trick there is to be the first to use it. Then you can tell the next guy can't.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
We're speaking to Stephen Gowans at gowans.wordpress.com on the issue of the Western leaders fearmonger to mobilize support for airstrikes on Syria. Steve, I had this notion that if the U.S. is what it calls itself, the indispensable nation, and if it is an exception, which is almost the illogical concept that America is exceptional in history, and Obama says he believes that to his bones, he believes it. And almost, doesn't that constitute a kind of caliphate? The American caliphate, its right to exercise its authority wherever it wants to.
I guess it does.
Yeah, that was kind of a cheating question. But it struck me that, you know, what they are so concerned about with this idea of, wow, a caliphate from the Muslims, they've already got one of those, except it's got an air force and a navy and nuclear weapons. Let me take you to this question of the Ukraine. We have, if you don't mind, I know you didn't, this wasn't what your essay was about, but I know you're watching very closely. The present situation, according to the president of Ukraine, is the most dangerous since World War II. His forces don't seem to be doing all that well. What is your estimate of the danger this situation represents?
Is it dangerous? I'm kind of undecided about that. You could argue that it's not as dangerous as some would suggest. This certainly is a vital or a very important issue for Russia, and I think more important for Russia than it is for the United States and the West.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the West would really be compelled to escalate or allow the conflict to escalate. I think the Russians would allow the conflict to escalate because this represents or this threatens their vital interests.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the West is able to absorb Ukraine wholly into its orbit, I don't think is a vital Western interest and not something that Western governments would really be willing to go to war for.
Mm-hmm. There is talk, of course, that everyone's watching the capitals of Europe, and will they continue down this road if they know it's going to cost them? There's talk about the problems with the German economy and also the French. Would they the question is they're sort of caught between two sides, in a sense. Their project was to cooperate and with Russia and develop the economies together. There seems to be now a new policy. No, we're going to go back to hardball with the Russians. But the problem with that is that the first people to pay the price in the so-called Western world are going to be one assumes, the Germans and others. And I, for example, the leader of Hungary and the leaders in Czechoslovakia, pardon me, the Czech Republic and the Republic of Czechoslovakia, are not very enthusiastic about going forward with this policy of no trucker trade.
Yeah, I mean, Europe is in economic difficulty at the moment. I mean, that's on the precipice of deflation. And the Western European governments are making a show, I think, of being tough on Russia. But how tough are they really being? I mean, the French certainly want to continue to sell their aircraft carriers to Russia over the objections of some other countries. And the German government has had difficulty garnering support for the policy of imposing sanctions on Russia. And one of the interesting things you might have seen in the press is that there had been talk about the downing of that airliner, which was attributed to either the rebels or to Russian forces. It was pointed out that this had done a lot to get the German population on board sanctions, almost as if that was used necessarily to drum up support for the sanctions. But I would think that the Western European governments are lukewarm, really, on supporting this.
And what are, there's this also this matter about the headline in the Toronto Star was NATO is caught off guard. That's not my memory of NATO's role in all of this. If when you would go back to last winter, when you had a dramatic breakdown of the Ukrainian government and a sudden shift in new leaders came in, NATO seemed to be very enthusiastic and was coming and going there, and the head of the CIA even paid a visit without telling anybody he was there, and then later saying, oh yes, I did make that visit. There doesn't seem to be any questions here that NATO originally was not conceived to as an instrument against Russia. Allegedly, it had to do something to do with communist Soviet Union, which is now gone. So, yet NATO continually talks about itself as very necessary, and maybe we should become. But again, as with Syria, aren't they sort of throwing aside all kinds of agreements and understandings, such as there will be no NATO operation in Ukraine? Wasn't that part of the deconstruction of the former Soviet Union?
Yeah, and if they were caught off guard, it was only in the sense that they didn't anticipate the Russian response to what was clearly a provocation. And some have argued they should have known that this would be the Russian response, because they did clearly provoke Russia in trying to incorporate Ukraine into the Western orbit and trying to push NATO right up to Russia's borders. I mean, inevitably, this was going to provoke some kind of response because it was a dire threat to Russian interests.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, it was, again, you know, sometimes you want to say, let us look at the fine print of the contracts, because it involves such things as nuclear capacity and nuclear weapons. And that was a touchy subject, as they decided that, okay, Ukraine will be independent. That was part of what was being explicitly discussed. And to say, well, now I changed my mind. You know, okay, you changed your mind. Let's look at the contract again. Is that your signature? In the case of Syria, and again here, they actually treat international agreements kind of like, oh, I'm going to shrug that off. That's where wars come from.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah, and NATO is really, well, it's become clear that NATO is simply an alliance against Russia in particular, and China. And it's raison, it doesn't really have, well, it doesn't have the raison d'etre it's said to have. I mean, it was once said to be a response to the Warsaw Pact, but it could hardly have been that, since the Warsaw Pact was established well after the establishment of NATO. And now it's incorporated many of the countries that were in the Warsaw Pact, and it's expanded. And exactly what it is an alliance against?
Mm-hmm.
What threat? And it continues to expand. If it's an anti-NATO or anti-Russian alliance, as you could argue it always has been, it's simply following its logic.
Yeah. They originally, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was a specific group of states, et cetera. And now they have this applicant system. You can sort of like becoming part of the European Union. You can put in your application and you fill out all the forms and whatnot. And then they try to fast track some. In the case of Georgia, I noticed Georgia comes up often when they talk about Ukraine, and there were some, when Ms. Tymoshenko was the leader of Ukraine, there was a skirmish in Georgia where the Ukrainians debated jumping in on the side of Georgia against Russia. So it's not as though this is all just happening, you know, as a result of the latest crisis. This seems to be NATO continually trying the doors and checking the windows of somebody's house that they don't own.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. And I mean, how would the United States react if China established a military alliance with Canada and Mexico?
Yeah.
It's the same kind of idea.
Yeah, probably was.
But to justify all of this, you have to obviously present the Russians as being aggressive. And I mean, this campaign to present Putin as some kind of devil and Russia as being the aggressive force in this case is completely ridiculous.
Yeah, I think Orwell would be impressed at how quickly this has all been accomplished. It's pretty much like you went to bed, he was a nice guy, and you got up and you hate him. You're not sure why, but by golly, you hate him. Let's talk about the crisis, if I could, about in relation to your article again, and it's titled Western Leaders Fearmonger to Mobilize Support for Airstrikes on Syria, Stephen Gowans, and it's gowans.wordpress.com. What is it about our Western parliamentary system that causes us to be in a situation where there's no discussion here? These are two very dangerous situations, but safe. On the one of Syria, why we're not interested in subjects like sovereignty and coordination with a sovereign country against terrorists?
Well, it might be the issue of sovereignty, really, because when you think back about the countries in which the Arab Spring happened and in which Western countries have intervened in Syria and Libya, I mean, what distinguished these countries from Egypt and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia? I mean, what distinguished them was that they were pursuing independent economic and foreign policy, whereas Egypt and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia are certainly allies or satellites of the United States and have opened their doors to U.S. economic penetration and have favorable investment climates, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Libya didn't have a favorable investment climate for Western corporations and investors, and nor does Syria.
Mm-hmm.
So toppling the Syrian government looks like it might be promising for business.
Mm-hmm.
They looked like it might be promising in Libya, too, but things didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, I suppose, by the way, I mean, the other thing is that people say, oh, golly, you created a mess, don't create another mess. But, you know, mess seems to be what they do. Afghanistan's a mess, Iraq's a mess. That is, as long as they are the ones who have hegemony, and as Hillary would say, we can fly over there, and it was a time we couldn't. So now they can wait out a problem, which is ugly. Might be ugly for the locals, but it's not ugly for the people living within continental USA.
Yes, that's right. And that's another reason why this can happen. I mean, I think as someone once said about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which was the U.S. population never broke a sweat, and these were the only wars in U.S. history in which there was not a levy on taxes to pay for them.
That is amazing.
But, I mean, the debt has certainly risen considerably. And however, now there's attempts to attribute that debt to entitlement spending, and no talk at all about the vast increase in military spending that was necessary to pursue those wars.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, U.S. citizens pay. They might not see the direct connection between those wars and increases in taxes, or more probably, reductions in entitlements and social programs.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen Gowan, it's great talking to you. It's Western Leaders Fearmonger to Mobilize Support for Airstrikes on Syria. It's a great article, and it's at gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. And it's a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM, or on Facebook/ The Taylor Report. And we're, of course, Taylor-Report.com. And I think we've just about covered it. I want to thank Lucas and Phil Conlon, and we'll see you next week.